Welcome back to Dog Parentology, where we explore complex behavior cases through neurobiology, psychology, and system science. We take deep dives into the real-life challenges of living with and supporting dogs with difficult behavior histories. It's season two, and in our very first episode, we start with a powerful conversation with Roman Godfrey of Holistic Dog Training, packed with insights for both dog parents and professionals. We begin with one of the hardest conversations I have in my practice. When a dog parent calls me and tells me, "We've tried everything. The trainer didn't work. The vet isn't helping. If you can't fix this, we're putting the dog down." And I tell them, "I won't take you on." Why, you may ask? Because once that door is open, it becomes an easy exit the second things get difficult. And behavioral change isn't easy. For example, it takes a minimum of 3 months, and there are ups and downs. That's exactly where my conversation with Roman begins, but it doesn't end there. First, you should know that Roman is a holistic behavior consultant, an advocate for trauma-informed canine care, and someone who has spent years working with dogs that others would call too far gone. Like me, Roman comes from a corporate background, having worked as a product engineer, which means he thinks in systems naturally and applies a true understanding of the term holistic, meaning beyond the dog to all the influences that allow behaviors to emerge. Second, Roman challenges the outdated siloed approach to dog behavior, where vets, trainers, and behaviors often fail to collaborate, leaving dog parents unsupported and dogs without options. Because of his system-based thinking, our conversation extends beyond just behavioral strategies. It explores the entire ecosystem around the dog and how healing must happen on multiple levels. In this episode, we discuss how trauma in dogs is often misunderstood and what the real red flags are. Why early life experiences, including breeding and socialization, shape behavior long before problems arise. The disconnect between trainers, vets, and dog parents, and how better collaboration could prevent so many unnecessary struggles. The role of intuition in dog parenting, why dog parents often know more than they think, and how to refine that knowledge instead of dismissing it. The future of dog rehabilitation, what needs to change in the industry, and what success actually looks like. This episode is filled with insights, personal stories, and actionable takeaways to help dog parents and professionals approach behavior rehabilitation in a truly integrated way. And for patrons of the show, we're creating a listening guide to accompany this episode, a resource that helps you track key insights and take notes on what applies to your dog and prompts you with questions to reflect on after the episode. If you'd like to access this guide and want to support this podcast, you can become a patron today at the link in the episode notes, all for the price of treating me to a small coffee. Also, if you haven't already, take a moment to subscribe, give a like, and share this episode. Your engagement helps us reach more dog parents and professionals who need real science-based strategy to help their dogs without the barrier of cost. We start this conversation casually, right as I was figuring out the recording software, but very quickly, we got into the hard truths about behavioral euthanasia, trauma, and what it really takes to help a struggling dog. Let's get right into it. Here's my conversation with Roman Godfrey. Okay, so let's get that going. I'm learning this product, so it looks like it's recording now.
Good. Well, I'm happy to assist you with that part because I'm doing that for a couple of years.
Oh, have you? Okay.
Yeah, I spent a ton of money on StreamYard.
Well, I'm a solo podcaster, so I don't do this normally. But anyway, what we were saying is I do get calls that say they want permission to put their dog down. And in many cases, they've talked to me too late. they've already made the decision. And as a matter of fact, Roman, I have to tell you, if they come to me and state, like, they want to work with me and with the dog, but if I can't do anything, they're going to put the dog down, I tell them, no, I'm not going to work with you. Because the minute that's on the table, it's like a really easy trap door that they will pull.
Definitely.
The second it gets hard.
Oh, you failed. I'm not pushing that to you, obviously. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. So tough times. On that side, what I was thinking about doing today, and it's if it happens or it doesn't, that's my husband in the background that's now being recorded.
Husband. Oh, we need the dogs here. Oh, he's taking the dog.
No, the dog is going to be click-clacking on the floor. Usually she'll sit here, but she's just after lunch for us, and she will be like a little bit restless before she can settle, so.
Are you East Coast North, up north?
Yeah, I'm in, so if you think Toronto, we're just north of Toronto, if you're familiar with that. Yeah, where are you? I was wondering that too.
I'm on the other side, Eugene,
In Oregon. Oh, okay. I've been there before, but a long time ago.
I used to be in Connecticut a couple of years back, but.
Oh, okay. What I was thinking for today, just to go over, and we can decide if we want to do this or not, but there was a very interesting case, and of course we were talking before a lot of issues happened for both of us, and we were talking about a Cavalier Spaniel, a case that came across my desk, and I just finished one from Anchorage, Alaska, funny enough, but I get people writing from me from all over the world asking for some help, and that's unpaid. That's just me helping them out because they've seen something I've done and say, hey, can you help me out? And I just say, yeah, sure. And then so I had this Cavalier Spaniel come across my desk, and there was a lot of oddness to it. And I thought it was an interesting case for us to talk about. It's not really a case. It's more like, here's things that fall onto my desk and what do you do with them? So it's not about coming to full resolution, but at least the steps to help a dog parent get started and moving forward. And you and I are so aligned when it comes to dog parenting and, of course, compassionate and kind care to all living beings. So I thought that might be of interest, but it does present some interesting questions that we can ask of the case and flow from there. As I'm in this middle of this huge move, and I don't even know whether we're going to land on this place. I thought we were, but then we got the inspection report today, which we've been.
Tell me about that.
Well, yeah, you know about that? Okay. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway.
Put some good energy on it. Put some good energy on it.
Yes, you're right. Yes, good energy. Yes. I'll tell you about the areas as if I'm a caller, if you'd like. Okay, so I'll just tell you the general part is that I'm going to call it the dog star because I don't like to use the real names. So there's general timidity. So this is a dog that came from a purebred breeder. And there's some challenges with that whole concept because not concept, but the person where they're not sure that it's actually a purebred breeder or her standards. The dog came really timid. So avoidance behaviors, hiding, not engaging with humans or the environment. It was cringing and tensing when touched, indicating a fear, potentially. It could be other things. There was physical concerns. There was initial dehydration, which makes you really question the breeder, dry eye, and a history of ulcers. And this was a puppy. Fragile body condition described as bony. Then the dog was triggered by loud noises, sudden movements, and interactions with other dogs. There was obviously a behavior of avoidance of the adult son that lived in the house. There was barking and hiding. There was a reluctance to walk on leash, but that's been improved to some degree, she said. There was extreme startle response, potential trauma-induced responses, which you and I will get into for sure. And then the caregiver talked about preferring being hand-fed and avoiding dishes on the floor. Just in a intervention we did very briefly, we helped her with that. She got past that. That was so simple. And then meal times involve hiding in crate or behind furniture. So there's a lot of fear here. So when we look at this, what are some of the red flags that we see that might indicate trauma or attachment issues? All of them, right?
Right.
Go ahead.
When we're dealing with this kind of information, there is the owner's story that we have to filter out.
There is
the dog's story, the real story. The dog doesn't tell his story, but he shows the story. So what we can do is start reverse engineering based on all these clusters of behaviors, what is likely to have happened. So we see we have nutritional issues. We see we have startle responses. We see the dog has problems with touching. So that alone speaks loud neglect. And that includes a lot of things, right? So basically, in the very early stage of the puppy, without having any clue about the puppy itself, I'm just grasping what I got, I would say just the biological needs are deficient. So my main focus would be looking into recreate a somatic experience of what have happened, create a kind of a new scenario where your dog is going through from scratch what could have happened. Now, I don't remember the dog's age.
Oh, what was the dog's age? Just a second. So the dog would definitely be probably about 6 months old.
Okay. That would fall into the category early puppy trauma and eventually pre-existing trauma.
Yeah.
Pre-birth trauma. So if their parents had that particular trauma, there's a lot of information coming down the line, which means it sounds to me like a backyard breeder or commercial breeder, like facility breeder. And that comes in with so much heavy load, lack of early puppy development, definitely emotional and social underdevelopment, plus nutritional deficiencies. So I would definitely start with a vet visit.
Yeah.
A holistic vet visit, so we can rule out kidney issues, thyroid issues, immune issues, because all these things and digestive issues and parasites, all these things have to clear it out. And I would go to definitely integrative or at least holistic vet.
And one of the things that she's also mentioned from an observation perspective are signals that show neurobiologically that there is some impairment of the limbic system, because when we're dealing with, and the in the limbic system, of course, is the executive functioning, the way that we make our decisions. And so we can see that the startle response and things like that, it's, she's really working from, I call it upstairs and downstairs. So she's working from the downstairs brain. The downstairs brain is functioning and fully in control. The upstairs brain isn't even coming into play here, because if the upstairs brain was coming into play, you would see much less of the avoidance behaviors, much less of the startle responses and that sort of thing. So I agree with you completely. Vet is first. Let's get rid of any sort of parasites, biological issues. But many vets here don't, that aren't studying behavior, systems thinking or systems dynamics in dogs, don't think about the feedback that can happen in a neurobiological loop, whereby that bottom part of the brain, that amygdala, goes, ah, I got all these problems, and doesn't feed up to anything that's, I always call the upstairs brain, like the oversight, the boss. And there is no boss right now. That doesn't mean that there can't be a boss, but right now there's nobody helping that poor pup make a decision except for survival, which,
you know. We see, it seems like that dog has been consistently under stress. Yes. Like the dog hasn't chronic had time to get out of that. So we're looking about a chronic situation here.
Yes, and absolutely.
Comparing gut's brain axis, that can also influence the decision. If the dog has a digestive issues, and definitely dogs with neglect have digestive trauma, if you see that from an energetic perspective, it's a stuck trauma. So the dog would not be able to function if that stuck trauma is not released.
Couldn't agree with you more on that one, that's for sure. And maybe we should talk about this one, is what should dog parents ask breeders to ensure a healthy supportive environment, what would be some of the questions that she could have asked before? Like, how can we prevent a person saying, hey, here's a breeder. I always hear this. The website's gorgeous. She's got a lot of good reviews. I'm going to get that puppy. How do we prevent that, Roman?
The good thing is I've lived with a breeder, with a champion breeder, and I've seen the inside world and the outside world of it. And as a classic person who was in the belief system, adopt and shop, which I believe is a valid, I would say, if we go into the direction, you have to choose an ethical breeder. Ethics is a big question mark, and what we perceive as ethics. Yes. Forcing a dog to be bred is not ethical. And having dogs roaming around breeding themselves is not ethical either. So there's a thing going on, but I don't want to go into that direction. However, if I would have to choose a breeder, which I don't, but in that case, in that direction, the first thing I would look for is, what is the breeder setup? Who is the parent? What is the breeder breeding for? Is the breeder breeding for look, or is the dog breeder breeding for behavior? Or is a dog a breeder breeding for breed preservation, which is always, right?
Yeah.
From that perspective, if I don't see the place, I don't trust it.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about, is the corners clean or is there a refrigerator dried? No, I'm looking at what's the setup. Where do the dogs live? Do the dogs live in the family or are in the separate conditions?
And I think in this case, one of the biggest red flags that I read is a breeder who says, no, because we're so far away, I will meet you with the puppy. It's no. You have to have a face-to-face conversation, not even video call. Yeah. Yeah. You immediately know something's wrong. It should be as obvious as if an electrician showed up to your house to do electricity work and all he has on him is a wrench. You should have red flags. So right. I think for anybody listening to us right now that is thinking about purchasing a puppy from a breeder, regardless of the ethics of that choice, which I'm not getting into, but if you should want to purchase a pup, then the challenge becomes making sure that you're able to travel to that place and actually be able to have a one-on-one conversation. There's right. never going to be a good reason to get a puppy off from the back of somebody's car.
Right? Definitely not. Okay. And I would say stay local, as local as you can get.
As local as you can get.
You know where they live, you can go there and ask questions.
So in this dog that we have, one of the areas that I was interested in is the fear of that human touch. And is it fear, right? So the dog was very worried about the sun, which could be all mm-hmm. sorts of issues. And there's also the fear of actual touch. Mm-hmm. And I have a method that I use, and I know that you'll have several, and we can discuss the interconnections of them, because I'm a big believer in equifinality, which is a big $10 word for we can get to the same outcome in 100 different ways. So what I do and what you do, as long as we get to the same outcome, as far as I'm concerned, same thing. Mm-hmm. I set up the human caregiver to learn how to establish a dialogue with the dog. Actually, I use it as a vehicle to ask the dog if they would mind being touched and indicating that touch with a single two-step, can I touch you here? A place that isn't highly sensitive. And allow the dog to say no, which, as you and I both know, is the flicking of the eyes sideways, the tipping of the head back, moving away completely, or fast lick of the hand. And all of those are no's. And I teach that and then have a response for the human being to say, don't worry, I'm not going to touch you. And to stop at that point. So the dog learns, maybe for the first time, that their body's going to be respected. In dog terms, because I don't want to make the dog into a human, but it's probably the first time that the dog's actually been asked something and being able to give a response and being respected. Now, in your body of work, Roman, when you're seeing a dog that is really scared of being touched, what sort of things do you do?
I take off my watch.
Tell me. Thing
is, there is no timer.
No timer. Lovely. I love that. Yeah.
It is a traumatic experience. It goes with the speed of the dog. So
right.
Winding back a little bit, you said a word we cannot compare dogs with children, dogs with people, but I would say we're both mammals.
Yes.
And the way our system works is very similar. We may have, dogs may not have ego, we do. But so if we go down that level, they have similar family systems. We have similar family systems. They have all the, most of the feelings that we have, just more complex feelings. We have ego, they don't have ego. We can literally go very close comparing what dogs feel about certain situations. So consent, as you mentioned, is the vehicle to building trust.
Yes.
And one of the core steps to healing trauma and creating a solid, secure attachment relationship is building trust. So if the dog doesn't trust my hands, which a dog doesn't understand as a young puppy, what hands do, because hands behave like mouths.
Yes.
And if our hands behave like mouths, the dog thinks he's being mouthed at, which is uncomfortable because he's being attacked by two hands from his perspective, right?
Yeah.
And that makes the dog vulnerable. So if we behave like predators and the puppy in that vulnerable stage, the first experience of not feeling safe causes a chain reaction of things. And I'm talking of this kind of chain reaction of things.
Yeah.
Right? And so from that perspective, I would say, if we wind back, consent and let the dog make a choice if he wants to return. Now we have this need for the dog for connection. That's great. But that connection isn't following the dog. The puppy comes to the connection. The connection is just there. The puppy plugs in.
Yes.
And that is a healthy connection. If we chase the puppy around, we're going to show up as predators, which is not what the puppy needs. All we have to do is create that safe environment for the puppy to have that ability and feeling safe to ply those connections, which in future makes the dog being more social. So that connection education is what the dog later on has a social experience.
Yeah, and that's, you just said a really key part for me is that I don't believe, and I know in your practice it's the same way, is that solutions have to have longevity. They have to be for the lifetime of the dog. You're building a relationship.
Right.
And so many things that I've heard from you and in our discussions, and even what you've just said, relate to creating long-term changes. And I know that when I'm teaching skillful dialogue, one of the things that I like is because when this has been taught, no, I'm not going to touch you, or yes, now I'm going to touch you because you said yes,
right,
that it can then be evolved into all sorts of questions. It might have nothing to do with the body at all. And so what you're doing, which is the same thing that you've just said, is we're establishing a level of a relationship. The whole relationship's going to structurally going to be sound, but we're establishing ways of showing a dog that we are their family and something they can count on. Yeah, I like that.
As you mentioned, very nice, we have different levels of communication. As puppy grow up, the first thing they do is they don't really communicate. All they have needs.
Yeah.
And that way of communication is expressing their needs. And our responsibility as dog parents is to accommodate for those needs. The puppy doesn't have to communicate, doesn't have to ask any questions. Keep me safe, keep me fed, keep information coming. I just want to watch and learn to survive. That's the only way out.
Mm-hmm.
Once they figured out that they feel safe, then they have time and the brain is already developed to start having a two-way communication.
Yes, absolutely.
I come to look for hugs. Can I get hugs? Yes, no? And then all of a sudden, we can go up the route, but not all the dogs come to this cognition communication where the dog actually intuitive communicates with you and you intuitive get this information. You don't need to go to the bathroom because the dog expresses emotionally his needs.
Yeah.
So we have this good with children.
Yeah, it's a good point. This is interesting because we were discussing vets, and we could have a veterinary opinion in here, and we could have, in some cases, I have a trainer involved that's come in and asked for some support from me. And it's interesting because we have so many potential professional. And how do we honor a dog's unique journey when we've got all these different perspectives? How do you manage when you've got dog parents, you've got the dog itself, you've got the veterinarian, you might have a dog walker, you might have a dog trainer, and we're all trying to come together as a whole? How do you manage the dog's unique journey for that?
This is the moment where all these hearts are coming up on the screen. I feel very strong about multidisciplinary approach.
Me too.
In dog parenting.
Mm.
Unfortunately, the industry has split them apart.
Yeah.
The veterinarians don't talk to trainers. Trainers don't refer to veterinarians. The pet sitter has a clue and knows everything better. And all this mixes up. So I would say a good route to go in my perfect world would be having a parenting coach.
Yes.
Who is the hub, who be able to translate the language of the person who doesn't understand, help them navigate through the labyrinth of breed traits, and help them navigate through the proactive parenting and getting the puppy ready for this next level of experiences. Like I call it proactive trauma-informed parenting approach.
Yes.
And in that case, the puppy has to learn how to feel safe with the vet. The parent has to communicate with the vet and not feeling threatened by the vet and intimidated, because he has a PhD doesn't mean the client doesn't have intuition and says, my gut's feeling is my puppy hurts.
Yeah.
I don't see anything is the feedback.
Right.
Or I feel we should check his thyroid. No, he's looking fine to me. So yeah, I've seen those conversations, and we need to come in from a better perspective. Listen to your client. But the reality is a vet in 15 minutes cannot have that. There is no room for that.
And I think that you've hit on something here, because as a professional, I have people calling me because they're fed up with all the different noises, all different words, come at it with a strong facilitation background. And I think that having a group of people working on a dog requires expertise in facilitation, coaching, interpreting, as you say, simplifying, respecting all the different personality types and styles, but also being the advocate for the dog themselves, and maybe even the dog parents, because you and I are both very focused on the dog parents. So we keep the dog parent and the family, actually, is what we should call it, is the keep the family together. And so it would be very interesting for a role to be established. And I'm talking, it's not a new role. It's actually just naming it as a facilitator or a coach, right? I liked your word of the coach, but it does require more skills than I think that what is currently taught in dog training. Do you not agree?
I agree with you.
You probably know, and I don't know the details about your background, but you may know that I was an executive for banking institutions for 30 years. So my capabilities as an executive to facilitate tough rooms is right up there. And I have to tell you that I use that skill.
Let me give you a little bit of feedback, because not many people know that I have retired for 25 years in industrial engineering.
That's right. You were. Yeah, I remember that.
So don't get me into things that I'm involved, but broadband, food industry, medical industry, military industry, aviation, invention, universities. I had my fingers pretty much everywhere. One thing that helped me a lot is the system integration. Recognizing those individual values of different systems and see what is the common language here. How can we connect? Because each system is on its own individual, but we need the language to communicate one department with the other department and still speak the same language so we have the same result. So we always needed a person in between who organizes it, right? So we have a product manager who does these things, sales department and product production, and all these things are coming together as one person has to know everything. He needs to know how the sales department works. He needs to know how the production works. He needs to know how the inventors work, because he needs to know everything. Not perfectly, but he should understand this. He's fooling me right now. What are you trying to sell me? I'm not buying it, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that knowledge came to me when I'm working with dogs, but also my background in ancient Greek philosophy that says, keep things simple. What is the essence? What is the spirit of that? And so trying to make things simple without oversimplifying them, try to understand the essence of it. So as a parent, what is the essence? Why do we have puppies? What is the essence? What is the need to have puppies? And that responsibility, how can I navigate through this different stages? How do I communicate with the vet? What's my right? What's my responsibility? What can I claim? And so we have to build, as coaches in that case, we have to build the person's, the pet parent's personality and build them up, give them power.
Yes.
Because you have power. You can ask the question, don't leave the room, and then you get the answer. Just because he said so doesn't mean it has to happen. Just because he can doesn't mean he should.
So what do you think success, what does success look like for trauma recovery in dogs, do you think?
The dog's well-being. That little tail wagging, that free coming approach, that way of exploring the environment, this is success. So it would be very striking for us to put that upper limit where success is. Success may for that particular dog be not feeling scared, passing that threshold of exit to going outside for potting, feeling safe, not being hurt, all these other successes. So I would say success is like a rainbow. Which color are you looking at right now? The rainbow is there. Success is there. Which colors do you see? Do you see the entire rainbow? You just see part of it. And is one rainbow or the two rainbows? We don't know. So if the dog is the one who explains his own success, what we do is feed that consistently.
And it's interesting because if you step back one more from that, we could also say everything you've said, and also to have the dog parents find the dog as a valued family member, that the the dog parents are finding joy more than the frustrations, which we will all have with a dog. We all have them. But the joy of that dog, that they're finding it, that I would put into the success of achieving a dog that's recovered from trauma, is also the family around them is now seeing that they are capable of helping the dog, and they understand that the pathway is not linear and that it will continue to have feedback loops, ups and downs, that they have that awareness and understanding that the joy that they're going to get out of their dogs during the growth of that dog is purely understood.
I totally agree with you. I was coming from perspective, what's the success for the dog itself?
Yeah, lens, yeah, lens.
As,
yeah,
as a professional, absolutely confirm with you, the success has to happen, how this is becoming a unit.
Now, actually, sorry, Roman, I was just going to say, you talk through the lens of the dog. I talk to the lens of the dog parent. Let's talk about the lens of the professional.
Right?
There you go.
I would say that's my goal. I want to see the parents to be independent thinkers, being able to create the safe environment for the dog to thrive. That would be for me success. Telling me, hey, remember we had these issues? Yeah, I thought about it. And so I thought we should do that. And it actually worked out. And I'm like, yes, we're able to think through the process. We give them the foundation to start building on it.
So as a professional, when you think about the relationships you may have had to tackle in order to get to success, what is the success metrics around those relationships? Think about the vet and the dog walker and possibly another dog trainer. What are the relationship successes that you would see once you've gotten through this trauma recovery in a dog?
Good question. The client to be able to make informed, trauma-informed decisions, to choose the vet that is in alignment with the ethical considerations of the client and is able to listen to the client and able to listen to the dog at the same time. The other part is, if I choose another professional, is the professional in alignment with my belief system and my ethical considerations, and be able to open up and ask questions that are in alignment with the dog's best. Right? I had a client the other day, he called me a message. I need to go vacation, and I choose the one trainer that I used in the past. My dog stayed there 8 weeks. Okay. And I'm like, is that a good idea? How was your relationship with them? Oh, they were perfect. The dogs loved them. He was playing with his dogs. Yeah, this is your man. Be best friends with him. That's where your dog should stay the other day, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, I feel...
And it's interesting because I consider you as an equal, somebody that's a colleague of mine. And so I say to you, I believe you and I are the type of people that should challenge our fellow colleagues to raise their level of success, to include relationship building that goes beyond the dog parent and the dog, to go to the vet and any service provider that is within the dog's scope. And I'm even going to go further. I'm going to say, and if we can, when we can, that we also influence the community that's around the dog. And here's the thing with that, and I know that's a big thing, but I'm going to say it anyway, because when I'm dealing with dogs, for example, in a closed community like a condominium, one of the things we've done very successfully and made me feel like I had successfully helped a traumatized dog is that we sent out letters to not only the condo board, who was very upset with the dog barking all the time and some aggressive behavior in the hallways, and every neighbor on the floor of that dog and the people below. And what we did is we kept them informed of how the dog was progressing so that we could create champions out of everybody there. So that made me feel like when I don't really ever leave, I'm sure you don't either, but when I'm no longer right there to help and coach every day, that the support system's in place. So my challenge to everybody, and I think you and I should challenge people on this, is to say, think bigger. As a professional, if we're stepping into that facilitator role and creating the dialogue between a multifaceted professional group that's helping this dog, that we ensure that those relationships, as you said, also not only are elevated with different thinking, better questions. I love the concept of just learning to ask better questions. So we can leave people with the ability to ask better questions and also to establish as best we can the different systems that support a dog, which goes all the way out to, can't go further, but out to the community, the closest community to that dog outside of the family. I think that's where we should be working as a profession. And I think one of the reasons we haven't been working there as a profession is because we're still stuck in some conventional training modes. And I think that we really need to start functioning as professionals in a higher level that's more related to facilitation, relationship building, and so forth that we do with our dogs.
I think this is a very valid point, a very sensitive point. As somebody who is a crossover trainer, from very aversive to balanced to force-free to holistic, like all the range over, it was a tough ride to go from one place to another. And I, even though I regret all these choices that I made in the past, for me, it was a step up. I've been challenged by other people, like, why would you do that? And why are you thinking this way? And I was now convinced that it was my trauma brain that didn't let me think out of the box. But once I got out of there, I saw all these options available. I feel the way to get across that message is to speak those individuals or this community's language, because I was triggered by the change of language, right?
Yes.
As a crossover trainer, I see we have a different language in that field and we have a different language here. We have a more empathetic, sympathetic language there. We have a more controlling and let's call it authoritarian language over there. Those languages clash. We cannot listen to each other. It's triggering. We have to create a foundation. And actually, I'm on this place working now, creating a small academy for people who want, who are interested to transition, to help them go through the process, because it's an emotional process. It's not just changing tools and using different words. You're going through grief. You're going through fear. You're going through stress. You're going through regret. All these things are going on with the person. And sometimes he says, you know what? I should just go there where it feels safe to me because I have control of it. This is a grief process. And I think people cannot transition on their own. It's a lot of effort on our side not to point the fingers on it, but help them with examples that are easily recreated, right? If a client can follow through with the process, then everybody can go through with the process. If our language, let's call it the fourth grade level, then people with no training experience can understand what we're talking about. People complain sometimes because I'm not using scientific terms. I don't need to say, if I cannot explain to a 5 year old what's going on here, I don't need to use scientific words.
Yes.
Do I know them? I sometimes have difficulties expressing them because English is not my first language, but we still have to get the message across.
It's very true, because being somebody who's been, who often suffers from performance anxiety, I can tell you that one of the main things, if I stepped into the world of having to change everything I know to another way, which I've had to do several times in my career, but there's a tremendous amount of fear and yes, trauma, because you're dealing with whatever it's bumped up against, right? Inside you. And when you have that, you're going to fight tooth and nail because you feel like you're struggling for survival. When I first moved here in Huntsville, Ontario, which is where I reside at present, I came up against a tremendous amount of nastiness and aggressive dog trainers who didn't like my credentials. They didn't like who I was. They didn't like that I was positive reinforcement. And they went out to slander me every which way. Any post I put up, they were on it. There's a good part of this story, by the way, and I'll fill it in on what happened, because it actually goes to show to stay true to who you are. But it was very challenging. And having a place that supports like what you're talking about, Roman, I think would be extremely valuable, because it does create a tremendous amount of emotions inside of you as you're trying to be successful. Even if you're starting out and then you flip, or even if you think, is there another way or a better way? And you want to explore it. How do you explore that in a safe place? And so just to finish off what that good news story was, is one of my videos where I was talking about positive reinforcement, which now I've moved into intrinsic motivation, which I'll talk about. But the positive reinforcement, as wonderful as that is or was, is that we use compassion. Basically, it's the idea of compassion for dogs. And one of my videos talked about that, and that there's no need to harm a dog to teach it anything. And it got reposted with a lot of mocking. Who did I think I was? And then going into my credentials and going into my education and so forth and my experience. That got actually, what we don't know, we know now, is that the social media of that person that attacked me went out to thousands and thousands of people, where everybody got to see it. And you know what? There were so many people that reached out to me because they were looking for alternatives. He took my business from way down here where I was starting.
We appreciate
way up
that.
There. So that's awesome. Thank you. It was hard though. The first couple of days it was like serious imposter syndrome, but then I realized, and those things come up regularly for people that are starting off, that imposter syndrome, and to get that attack, but then to find out on the other end. It's actually cool. It's going to be great. Thank you so much. Let's do that again. And actually, I want to go back to something that you said earlier, if I can. You talked about dog parents' intuition and coaching them. So how do you balance professional advice with dog parents' intuition? How do you manage that?
So when we're working with clients, one thing that I notice that people have intuition, and we have intuition with people. We feel our children and we feel our parents, and somebody is in need. It doesn't have to call us. We feel the need to call them. Hey, I have a dream and thought about you. Everything okay? So there is something information out there that's tapping in. It's that emotional dimension that we can tap into. And so dogs have that too as species. They are social animals. They communicate with each other. Don't need to bark about it. They pay attention to their behaviors. But as Sheldrake specific said, dogs know when we're coming home. How do they know? Right? And take that in consideration. I ask my clients often to pick up that information. Are you intuitive? If you see your dog, do you sense sometimes he needs something? And then you do it and everybody's happy. Like right now, looking at your dog, how do you feel about it? Is there anything that you feel in your body, in your mind, in your thoughts, in your flavor that gives you an information? Oh, there is a need. Great. Okay. What need is that? Because I caught myself sometimes telling, I think your dog needs to go to the bathroom. He just went to the bathroom. Yeah, but maybe not completely. oh my God, you're right. He just peed forever. Or like, I can feel it. You can feel it. It's out there. So teaching them to tap into that energy and trust their intuition is helpful if you go to the vet, if you talk to a person, if you communicate with your dog and your dog starts taking that information, they're going to talk more. They're going to express more. Not all dogs do. It's not that it's like a blank slate claim dogs can do that. Some dogs do more, some dogs do less. I have a dog here who does it. He communicates a lot. Mm-hmm. It's almost too much chatting. So I don't want to hear it kind of thing.
Right? My dog talks a lot too.
Good information to have in the box. So in my mentoring program, I do have an intuitive class attached to it where people learn to start tapping intuition in different ways.
Very interesting. That is so interesting. I don't really do one-on-ones anymore because I do the podcast to get more information out to a broader group. But one of the things that, because I really admire that position, sometimes when I think about intuition is I'm dealing with a human being in front of me. I don't have the professional standing to say this person is traumatized, but everything from my own traumas tell me that I'm dealing with somebody that's traumatized, and their intuition can sometimes be wonky because of that. And the way I bridge that using systems thinking and my background in human psychology and change is that I ask questions before I onboard them that carefully ask some questions that allow me to see some flags. And when I say flags, I'm not talking about a red flag. I'm talking about a yellow flag, right? I'm not looking to find out all your key things. But one of the questions we ask, for example, have you just gone through or about to go through a big life event? Are you caring for an elderly parent? Are you woken up several times in the night by yourself or your partner? Things like that can tell me a lot about the sleep deprivation that might be going on in the home that's going to impact judgment, impact the brain, and so forth. So when I think about intuition, and in my experience, which is different than yours, the intuition I often find is flawed in my cases. And I wouldn't say that is 100%. And sometimes I do say, you're absolutely right. If you're reading your dog that way, keep reading your dog that way because you've got it, because I'm seeing it. But in other cases, I find that I get somebody that is very worried and mirroring that worry onto the dog. So that's been my primary experience, has been that. So it's so fascinating to me because I do like very much like feedback. And I like to always challenge myself to look 360 at a problem. Mm-hmm. And where are my blind spots? And I just found one with what you've just said. So I have a blind spot there that you've just pointed out and I've taken note of, is that perhaps the sense of intuitiveness can be developed in a human being where my experience has been different than that, where I don't see it. Balancing professional advice for up here, I do provide a tremendous amount of information to a vet prior to them speaking to the vet. So I act as a kind of a gateway to the vet. And a lot of people come to me because I am that gateway to their vet. They've had such trouble trying to get their vet to recognize what's going on with their dog for whatever reason. And it could be them biasing, putting a lot of prejudice on the dog, which is impacting the vet's ability. So coming in and doing that facilitation and really providing the vet with a very strong set of knowledge in which to look at and then focus in some specific decisions that they could make is something that I've done. So as I look at that question that I asked you, is how do we balance professional advice with dog parent intuition? I've actually been on the other side of it, where let's focus on the professional advice and kind of challenge ourselves on the intuition. But there's the blind spot that you've just pointed out to me. That might be, no, maybe we take a look at that intuition and try to develop it further. I like that. Thanks. That's a good answer.
I feel it's very important, that subject, because it is a missing piece of many professionals not taking that in consideration. And that intuitive level of setting up the session is also important, because sometimes you don't see the light, but you see the shade. Right. And
yes,
I think that's a good way to go with it.
Yes. Yes. That's a very good point. I know this is something that you and I've talked about a lot, and it may seem like a redundant question, but for the sake of people viewing this interview, I think it would be good to talk about what the role of time and patience is in healing a dog.
I don't see this as a time factor, because it's an experience that has to happen, but there's a process of the experience. And if we're not bringing that process in a proper timeline, then we will have a hard time reaching the goal. We can set up scenarios and we can set up the dog to be successful in a shorter period of time, or we can let it happen on its own and it's never going to get there. For my approach, working with dogs who have trauma is helping them change the story that they have from everybody out there is up to kill me into, huh, who's that? And it's a process. It has to happen in multiple levels. It had to happen the dog feeling trustworthy with his caregivers. They do build a secure attachment relationship, whether we like it or not, but is this relationship healthy, right? Goal of building that relationship is what we have. Where are we at? How far do we have to go there? So if we don't build that foundation, we will not go very far. So the time will be longer. If we build that foundation and make sure the dog is healthy and all his needs are met and their relationship is fine, now we can go and say, okay, now that we have created a good relationship, now we are in synchronization with what we're doing and how we feel about things, let's go out in the world and explore things. That can eventually accelerate the situation. And then if we set up the environment, even if that's a fake dog, exhibit A, a fake dog, for the dog who has a trauma brain, that is a reality. He sees that dog as a danger. His body responds to that.
Right.
Can I prove the dog, that idea that is a real dog, can be questioned. And once the dog questions that, so that is a dog or not? What do you think about that? That is also a healing process. Having the dog communicate on his own free will, sharing his feelings with somebody he trusts, taking his feedback to make further decisions, it's also a healing process. It's all a healing process. If we look at the dog as a trauma dog, but if we look at a dog just not with a trauma, just a regular dog, we just be born, everything is fine, perfect world, it's an educational process. It's preventative to trauma.
Yes, that's a good point. And then one of the things that I've found in my practice, and what I do, what I did in my practice, I have to say what I did, is I had a 12-week program. So that was it. And one of the reasons I did that from my corporate days is I knew I needed enough time to be able to make enough of an impact. And my concern wasn't the dog, it was the human being. And so they signed up for 12 weeks because I knew that in 3 months, that was the limited amount of time that I could make actually effective change in them and the way that they saw it. So when I think about time and patience, it's not, I believe in 12 weeks, we're going to get a really good start. I always say there's going to be a significant change in 12 weeks following our program. But there's the challenge, is I say following the program. And so when I'm putting down something that I'd like them to do and they don't want to do it because it's inconvenient, it goes back to what you just said, Roman, which is we could do something fast, but it's not going to be as effective as doing that long-term growth, that understanding that you've just explained so well of this being a journey, not a destination. And as I've mentioned at the beginning, I'm a big believer in equifinality, whereby there's multiple ways to get to the same solution, which is why I don't see any dog professional as being a competitor. I think we're all doing very good work. It's just different ways of getting to the same outcome. So when I get a dog parent that is pressuring me for results, the choice that I put in front of them is pros and cons, because this is what I learned to do as an executive, is you always put pros and cons down. If we do it fast, you will see only this amount of movement and it will probably go poof in a couple of months. Or we could do it with a longer run and you will have it for lifetime. Or, and this is the big one, you come up with a solution that we get to the same outcome in the same time with the same lifetime results. And it's important, again, as professionals to challenge ourselves to be open to a dog parent's both reluctance to do something and also open to facilitate a discussion where it's, I know this is going to take more time. What do you suggest? And be able to be confident enough to say, as long as the outcome is the same, we can get there. And I have seen several dog parents come up with brilliant ideas that fit their lifestyle, and it's worked. And I wouldn't have seen them because I am not the Wizard of Oz. I'm not the man. I don't know everything.
I really appreciate that you put that in place, and thank you for explaining the time process. Earlier, you mentioned earlier that I see it from a doctor's perspective. I got stuck in the same trap again, telling you the doctor's perspective of the healing process. However, you're referring to the professional setting in a training session. So let's wrap up a little bit backwards.
Yes.
I have two basic programs. I have the secure attachment program. That's basically a 3-month program where I walk people through their 12 sessions, going through that experience of building that relationship. Beautiful. So they're going to see results the first session, second session, yeah, third session, and it's going to build up and more is going to happen. We build relationship, we build communication skills, we teach them how to see each other and recognize each other, paying respect to their feelings and on the boundaries and personal space. That is usually what dogs who don't have trauma. With dogs who have complex trauma, don't have trauma, it's like a weird, they do have trauma, but it's not so intense that anybody's in a difficult position. For dogs who have complex trauma and they have a bite history and stuff like that, I have a behavior healing program. It doesn't have no end. It's open end. But I do have 14 sessions available, including 2 healing sessions. I use reconnective healing as a healing modality to address the energetic aspect of the trauma. It functions the same way it functions with people. Dr. Eric Perel has done an amazing work on setting that program up. And my wife, for example, she is specialized in animals, but also for people. So I grab her and put it in this program to address this invisible energetic aspect and trauma aspect, those missing connections that we need to have a progress. And I see a huge improvement. I think I've done over 200 sessions implementing that particular modality, which I swear on it. But also we have individual sessions with people going through an emotional connection with the dog. This is more the spiritual aspect of it, having people mm-hmm. understanding their connection they have with that dog. Why is this dog in your life? And what is the energetic and let's call it spiritual reason of that? So we look mm-hmm. into that a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's more establishing that space, that safe space for them to explore and communicate in a different level. Not wonderful. Everybody is on that page. So if somebody is on that page, they're going to take advantage of it. Somebody who's not, that's fine too. It's going to take a little bit longer, and it's like difficult for people to connect really with a dog. But I see that healing process usually depends on if it's separation anxiety or if it's complex trauma, if the dog has hurt someone, killed someone or something, and this more complex. It can last for 3 months to a year plus. And that's why it's open end. We just go as it can happen. And of course, we have multidisciplinary approach. We call in different people in, veterinarians, nutritionists, whatever we need to get this job done. So yeah, I agree. Some people need a time factor, and the time factor is either 3 months or open end for complex cases. Mm-hmm.
And many people like the time boxing, I find, but they get frustrated if they don't see results quickly. And that's when, like, I've always found that there is a big curve that they go through. Like, it's really important up front to say this isn't linear and that we are going to have times where you're going to feel like quitting right away. Like, just tell them that's the journey, so that we can recognize when we're in a point of learning, where the learning needs to be absorbed more before we can advance forward. So that, I like the fact that you're doing that. That's very helpful. And to those people that are going to be listening to, from my audience that are going to be listening to this, it would be great, Roman, to, if you would just wouldn't mind stating your website so that people might be able to find it, because I don't take cases anymore. I podcast.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. So my website is holisticdogtraining.org, holisticdogtraining.org. And I see people in person and online, mainly online. My reach is international, most English-speaking, German and Greek languages. And it just goes always case by case. So I'm not putting a book out of the shelf and says, follow these instructions. But yeah, I work mainly with people who want to be proactive rather than reactive. People who are in difficult situations and struggling with the dog's behavior, have been through multiple places and haven't found the really end of the story. And I'm trauma-informed, which means I need to understand exactly everything that happened and bring people to that level to see what I see as well. And yeah, that's...
I think this has been such an interesting discussion, because we've really gone across from a specific case to the human side of things, to the profession, and then back around to being able, what services need to be provided. So they definitely will have a good sense of who you are. From my perspective, I've decided to focus more on getting information out for free, making sure that people have my life work, which is really working in systems thinking, neurobiology, and psychology on complex cases with dogs, and letting dog parents learn as much as they can from the podcast to be able to keep dogs in homes, because we know that resurrendering happens a lot. We are packed here in Canada. All the shelters are packed with dogs having been rehomed again. So this is like after the COVID, they've just gone back into shelters, and that just continues the trauma. So the mission of the Dog Parentology podcast is to provide free information on a variety of topics that provide a systems thinking lens, so that we're looking at all the interconnected facets of why a challenge of behavior exists. And we put that out about once a month. That's well researched. Anybody wanting to tune into that, I ask you, if you just subscribe to the podcast, that helps keep the information flowing. So all the work I do right now, I don't earn a penny for. I'd like to at some point, but let's have YouTube pay for it and keep the information flowing. So I think we've done a good job here, Roman. And even though we can continue on, let's just close out the podcast, unless you've got anything else that you wanted to add to this.
I appreciate what you do. And you. I'm not easily to get on a video and talk about things. So I appreciate the opportunity, and I love your perspective and your scientific approach in putting those things in place. And I wish you get a sponsor to have that going even further out, because this free information, just because it's free, doesn't mean it's quality. But you put quality to that free information, people have a hard time grasping, because there's so much free out there, and your free is better than the other frees.
I recognize that saying free automatically reduces the quality in people's mind. But we do take great care to take a tremendous amount of science and research before we put out any podcast. So thank you for that. Yeah. Greatly appreciate it. Thank you for meeting with me today.
I'm curious to see questions from people hearing your podcast. So thank you so much for that.